At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Well, here we are on lockdown. How are you? It's Booker of the Perez Hilton Podcast with Chris Booker. We get it. We know you're bored. We're still doing shows. We're keeping you up to date with everything entertainment. A little bit of relief from everything that's going on in the world. You could get the show on Spotify. You could get it on your Apple Podcasts or the Podcast One app. Whatever you do, download and subscribe and get the PHP, the Perez Hilton Podcast with Chris Booker. And everything that's entertainment will be covered.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFL.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
You just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam. So, who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football. I like football season and all the things that go with it.
Welcome into the PFF NFL podcast. Wait, that's my old intro. Welcome back to the PFF NFL podcast. NFC West preview. Sam.
Your old intro makes sense because you're back in your, where is it, your attic? Leaving
my
me
office.
Alone. In the studio.
It's my office. But we'll discuss that in a minute. Right now, I want to tell you about our friends over at Monkey Knife Fight, all first-time depositors at Monkey Knife Fight that put at least $20 into their account while using the promo code PFF will receive a free PFF Edge annual subscription. I had no idea. What? We're giving away PFF Edge?
Free.
That's a $40 value for just the $20 deposit, and you'll get the opportunity to turn that $20 into even more money playing daily fantasy and prop games at one of the fastest growing fantasy sports sites in the USA in Monkey Knife Fight. Go to Monkey Knife Fight and deposit your $20 with promo code PFF today, and you'll receive a free PFF Edge annual subribscription. All right, Sam, it's NFC West time.
Hang
I'm
on.
At home.
You can't just start things up like that. What? Why are you not sitting across the desk from me?
We're just taking precaution.
Uh-huh. So you may be a carrier now, is what you're telling me.
I may have been exposed to the virus. So we're taking precaution. I will know for sure tomorrow that I don't have it, okay. And I'll be back on Monday.
I don't know what the camera is. I can't see what, but I've made some alterations while you haven't been here.
It looks amazing.
Put our faces
that
up
is like
us.
I heard that it was happening, and I didn't think it was going to look that good. Not
right.
Gonna lie.
I think it looks
That's
pretty
awesome.
Cool. Next, we need to work on comfortable chairs because I'm getting pretty fed up with these stools.
Next one's comfy chairs, yeah. And then we need some like helmets that match what we want back there. We just, you know, a little bit more for the background there.
I can't believe I gave away my Rhino's helmet. I got to get a new one from somewhere.
Yeah, let's order a Rhino's helmet. Maybe I'll get a little like a AAA hat, not a major league hat, like a minor league baseball hat. I didn't make.
Wait,
it to
didn't
the
you
leagues.
Get? Did you get a whole bunch of swag when you got called up to sit in the bullpen for like 5 minutes?
No,
nothing.
You pretty much had swag. Like they give you enough swag in the minors. They gave me
like
a jersey with no name on it.
Yeah.
And I was number 98.
And of course, because you're not like a hitter, you don't get a helmet or anything cool.
No, I don't get it. I didn't get anything. Yeah. Nothing cool.
That kind of sucks.
I got a nameless jersey that I needed to return. But I have some swag. I've got some Mariners and Giants swag. I got some stuff.
It doesn't seem like you did that well out of the whole baseball career, to be honest.
My Spalding contract, dude.
Yeah.
I had the glove contract. Well, I got two free gloves per year,
I mean,
plus that $2,500 bonus if I won the Cy Young.
Should you win the Cy Young anytime in the future, you'll be doing well. But, you know, like, so you have, you got given like one nameless jersey that you had to give back. Bud Grant has been having a garage sale for like the last 8 years and is still eBaying crap out from his basement. Like, you know, there's a whole different level of free swag going.
Well, Maybe I missed out. Maybe I missed out a little bit.
Yeah, it seems that way.
All right, NFC West.
Yes.
Let's get to it. It's our last division. Don't forget, the first seven are out there. You guys have been loving it. We appreciate all of the support. I could feel the buzz, Sam. The season's right around the corner. People are getting ready. They're believing that football is going to happen. So let's wrap up our preview series, and then on Monday we'll circle back and just, you know, it's like season mode for us. We'll hit up all the news and all the fun stuff. We'll have a little we might have a little embrace debate session with the PFF forecast. You
we
guys
also,
got to a little tussle.
We also think we fixed the issue that was throwing up 2019 episodes for anybody at the start of this. So if you are one of the thousands of people that got punted the 2019 AFC East preview, go back and find the real one and listen, you know, because they're there now.
It was a naming issue. We renamed it 2020.
Yeah.
We'll get into your tussle with the forecast maybe on Monday, and maybe we'll have a little little sparring session with you and Eric.
Verbally, right? Because he's large.
All right, let's start the Arizona Cardinals. We're going alphabetically through the NFC West. Is this? I asked this about the South. Is this the most difficult division in the NFL? All of them are.
I think it might be. You've got. I think all four teams could be formidable. There'll be varying degrees of that, but you've got defeated Super Bowl champion 49ers, who were like a play away, you know, at any point in the Super Bowl from winning. You've got the Seattle Seahawks, who have the only quarterback in the NFL essentially capable of going toe-to-toe with Patrick Mahomes on a regular basis, or at least just playing at that kind of level, albeit in a different system and with different requirements and different volume of his passing. You've got the Rams, who are not that far removed from being in the Super Bowl themselves. Obviously, things have sort of unspooled a little bit for them, but you do have this boy genius coach in Sean McVay. You've got a lot of pieces still there. And then you've got the up-and-coming Cardinals, who were not terrible last season with a brand-new head coach with a completely new system to the NFL, not just to the Cardinals, and Kyler Murray, you know, first-year quarterback who is presumably going to come on leaps and bounds in year two.
Yeah, let's discuss those Cardinals. As you mentioned, you know, the offense early on was really heavy spread. They were using more, what was it, like four times as much 10 personnel. That's four wide receivers and one running back, like the old school run and shoot, the current air raid. They were using like four times as much as anybody else in the NFL through about 6 weeks. Then they started to use more two tight end looks with Max Williams. Last year they had Charles Clay. So they evolved a little bit. Here's the number that stood out to me. Their run blocking wasn't great, but they had the second most yards before contact for their running backs. And then from a pass protection standpoint, remember the previous year with Josh Rosen under center and a little bit, remember there was like two games of Sam Bradford, maybe the worst offensive line we've ever seen.
Yeah.
The 2018 Cardinals, they all developed. DJ Humphries had a career high pass blocking grade. J.R. Sweezy, I believe, had a career high. Justin Pugh bounced back and was pretty good. Justin Murray at right tackle was actually reasonable from a pass pro standpoint. That scheme helped protect those guys. The unfortunate part was Kyler Murray was holding the ball a little bit too long. He invited more pressure that was his fault than any other quarterback. All that to be said, I think the scheme early on did a nice job of just working with what they had from an O-line standpoint, from a personnel standpoint. I'm excited to see what they do in year two.
Yes. I think fundamentally the real key to this team going forward, I think, is that, you know, Kliff Kingsbury came in with this Texas Tech air raid system, you know, the extreme even by college standards in terms of the hyper spread kind of look, as you say, 10 personnel all over the place and all that kind of thing. And he modified that as the season went on. Like this time a year ago, everyone was talking about, what is this offense going to look like? Is he going to go 100% air raid? Is it going to be pure college system? And does that function in the NFL? And I think he certainly tried that. I think he certainly attempted to start off and basically bring the air raid right into the NFL. And then as the season wore on, he realized that, you know what, it doesn't work 100%. Like, there needs to be some modifications to account for narrower hash marks, to account for better defenders, to account for just better play at the NFL level, period. And he pivoted. And the fact that we saw that growth throughout the season, I think, is really important. But there's a lot of elements to this offense that clearly do function at the NFL level and are friendly to a lot of the offensive players. Like, there's a reason that this system is so prevalent in college. It's because it's easier for most of these players to function in. So these hyper wide splits from the offensive linemen, you know, the distance between the two of them, abnormally wide for the Cardinals and for any other team. And you think intuitively that's a bad thing, right? The larger those guys, the larger the gap between those guys, the easier it is for somebody to shoot that gap and the harder it will be to pass block. But you're getting the ball out of your hands quicker and you're massively increasing the space between defenders as well so that the running backs have a ton of space to work with. The quick game helps the quarterbacks, all this kind of stuff. We saw a lot of the elements of this offense function well in year one. And I think it's really encouraging that A, the system did work that well right out of the gate with some modifications. And B, Kyler Murray looked as good as he did despite the negatives in his game. And you're right. We charged him for 23 sacks last season. 23 for the quarterback. So if he gets – we talk all the time that the first thing or the single biggest problem young quarterbacks have is holding onto the ball too long, processing too slow. So if that improves, that changes a world of problems for the Cardinals.
I'll talk about Kyler in a minute, but obviously the biggest news for the Cardinals, though, is DeAndre Hopkins coming in, and I think – the most important part of all of this, not only is you get a number one wide receiver, but less pressure on Larry Fitzgerald and Christian Kirk and Andy Isabella. You know, my thought is now those guys can slot in properly. Like, Larry Fitzgerald caught 24 screen passes to lead the NFL last year. Like, why would you be, what's he in year, like 20? Why is he catching all these screens? That stuff should be going to Andy Isabella, a former running back with 4.3 speed, or to Christian Kirk. Now I think Fitz can be more of the possession guy. Nuke Hopkins can be the go-to guy, obviously. Tight coverage, third down, whenever you need him. And then you get to use Christian Kirk's speed and Andy Isabella's speed. Keyshawn Johnson showed some things as a rookie. So I just think that having that number one wide receiver, the trickle-down effect is as important as, you know, what Hopkins is going to bring as, you know, what he's been a top three receiver over the last 4 or 5 years.
It's kind of amazing. Like, Larry Fitzgerald is essentially a direct contemporary of Andre Johnson. Like, they came into the league 1 year apart as the top receiver in their class. And Johnson last played in the NFL in 2016. Like, he's been basically out of the league for 5 years. Fitzgerald's still trucking on. Like, there's no difference.
Is still gone.
It's insane.
O-line-wise, we mentioned they took some – they progressed a little bit last year. We think that they stole Josh Jones in the third round, a first-round caliber tackle that will likely slot in as the starting right tackle. And then it comes down to Kyler. Here's the thing. When you look, if you have Premium Stats 2.0, you go find the Kyler Murray page, and he was on his way, man. Like, he was looking good, and then he hit that lull late in the season. He had back-to-back games against the Steelers and the Rams, which were just horrendous, and it ended up crushing his overall grade. And I know it's just two games, but it still happened. And it speaks to this point still that we always make about players don't just always get better. Like, Murray should have been, if that theory was true, peaking late in the season and then coming into this year as, like, remember the last two MVPs? Patrick Mahomes year two, Lamar Jackson in year two, and Kyler would have been getting some really good year two MVP hype, maybe even from us. But I think those last two games, they were poor. And, you know, kind of marred what otherwise was a pretty good rookie season.
Yeah, they do. I mean, we did this with Kirk Cousins a little bit, but you take those two games out of his season, his grade jumps up like 10 points. Those two games really, really crushed him. So it's not that you can't do that, right? You can't say, well, take them out and they didn't happen. Let's pretend. But if in terms of, like, projecting what a guy's going to be going forward, I think it's fair to say that those two games don't represent what Kyler Murray is and what he's going to be long term. Maybe he'll still have those games, but his baseline is so much higher than that. And his baseline is more accurate if you essentially toss those games out of the window, because he's fundamentally better than that. So I think this offense, Kyler Murray, Nuke Hopkins, A, Nuke Hopkins being there in the first place, and B, what he does to allow everybody to just take a step down the depth chart. Larry Fitzgerald going back to not having to be the bubble screen guy. Andy Isabella trying to find a role as a designated deep threat. This entire offense, Kenyon Drake, I think is perfect as a running back to take advantage of that wide split and the huge yards before contact figure that they generate, this offense, I think, can be really exciting. I don't know if it'll come together a year two or if it's a year three thing by the time it all clicks, but like it's time to start getting really excited about the Cardinals offense.
Yeah, and here's the one place I'm going to be keeping an eye on with Kyler. You know, I think the knock on him was height, and, you know, I think you and I and PFF in general, we like to, you know, laugh at some of the, well, this guy's too short stuff or this guy's too slow, and we just like to lean on production. But I think there's a little something to Kyler in his style and the way he plays, and we've seen it with other short quarterbacks. Drew Brees has to change the way he plays because of his height in the pocket and seeing the field over the middle and all that stuff. For Kyler, the middle of the field was not great last year. The intermediate level was not great. That 10 to 19 yard level, that is where everybody dominates generally, or the best quarterbacks tend to dominate. Kyler struggled 53 grade on 10 to 19 yard passes. That was among the worst in the league. So that's what I'll be watching. Does DeAndre Hopkins help open up that area? Can Kyler Murray do a better job of seeing that area, getting throwing the ball accurately there from the pocket over the middle of the field? Yeah, your boy Kenyon Drake was looking good with the space created there. I mean, they could be a pretty good offense, and it's definitely going to depend on Kyler, you know, taking that next step.
Yeah, the height thing, it's not that it's irrelevant and that it makes no difference to anything whatsoever. It's that if a guy is already a top prospect, right? And by that, it means he's proven at the college level that he can play well despite whatever height limitations he has. It's not going to suddenly become the reason he sucks, right? Like when pre-draft process, we look at these guys and we're like, well, why is this guy going to bust or why is this guy going to be successful? Like height is not going to suddenly be the reason a quarterback busts. Baker Mayfield, if he thrives or fails, it's not going to be because he was 6'1". Like Drew Brees didn't succeed or fail because he's 6 foot, and Kyler Murray is not going to succeed or fail because he's short. Like he's already shown he has the ability to overcome what the height limitations do. But like fundamentally, it's still a thing, right? Like if you're 5'10", you can't see over the guy that's 6'6" standing in front of you. It's just, it's impossible. So you need to show that you can get around that, and like figuratively and literally. And most of the time they do, but like maybe you're going to see that Kyler Murray is fundamentally a little bit worse at playing over the middle because he can't see as well as some of these guys that are 6'6". It doesn't mean like he's still going to be good.
I agree. You have to work around those. You have to work around those things though, if it is an actual limitation. Yeah. And again, last year, 53 grade. So of all the quarterbacks that had at least 25 attempts, Kyler was 38 out of 39 at that 10 to 19 yard range.
You know what? So
once again, most of the NFL quarterbacks were above 70.
Right. It's interesting.
Those are easier. That's where you win.
If you pull up his passing map in the PFF data, you can almost see like throwing lanes. Like it's not that he's terrible over the middle. There's some of it, but you can almost sort of see the windows that he's been hitting his passes with, between offensive linemen, because that's the way you have to work that is, look, I can't see over the guy that's 6'6", but I can see the gap between him and the next guy that's 6'6", and that's my throwing window. And even if I need to calculate it one window in advance, like that's how it functions. So you can almost see from his map that that's basically how he was operating, is between the bodies.
All right, so let's go to the defensive side of the ball. It's a zone-heavy scheme. They weren't great last year. They had one of the worst linebacking groups in the NFL from a coverage standpoint. They add in Isaiah Simmons, who's going to come in and play linebacker. Their top 10 pick filled a need. That was crucial. Like every other team, it's going to come down to that secondary. Patrick Peterson was not himself last year, either within the scheme or just with one-on-one. When he had to face like Emmanuel Sanders and, you know, decent route running receivers, was not good. And Byron Murphy was their second round pick. We thought it was a good scheme fit. Really liked him as a zone corner, but not a good rookie season. They bring in Dre Kirkpatrick. They're trying some things at cornerback. They need Byron Murphy to really take a leap forward, especially I think he's going to play more nickel this year. And then they just locked up Buda Baker as the most, you know, the highest paid safety in NFL history. Baker's a good player, but probably not that type of top dollar. What are your thoughts on the Cards D?
So you're right. They've been playing more zone than man, and yet the personnel screams more man than zone, with the exception of Byron Murphy, who they've almost given up on at this point, or at least are expecting to basically just be a slot guy only. Like, Drake Kirkpatrick, I think, is a better man cover corner than he is a zone corner, and I don't know that he's great at either of them. Patrick Peterson has been a better man cover corner than a zone corner throughout his career. Byron Murphy, I think, is better in zone, but like I say, they're already kicking him inside of the slot and minimizing what they want from him in terms of an outside cornerback anyway. And then you have the secondary group generally is interesting, because I think Buda Baker is a really good impact playmaker. There are some people sort of criticizing the move because he doesn't have a career interception in the NFL yet. And while I think that is a sort of
Who's doing that? Some just like GMs from the 80s and stuff? Who's doing that?
I don't know. People are out there. It's happening.
Okay.
And look, I think it's a fundamentally silly reasoning, right? Like, he doesn't have an interception, therefore he's not great, right? But I think it whether coincidentally or not, I think it does kind of speak to a question that you have about Buda Baker, or even about the defense generally, which is, like, is his deep coverage good enough to warrant either that role or that money? And if it so, he might be worth the money in a role that isn't a deep-lying free safety. But then who's going to play deep-lying free safety for the Cardinals? Because that seems to be the hole in this defense as a unit to me. Is I don't see the guy that mans that deep free safety role. And at the moment, Buda Baker is doing it, and I don't know that he's actually that great at it.
Yeah, some of the notes I had on Baker from last year, you know, he works downhill extremely well, like blows up screens, one of the number three in run stop percentage last year. You know, he attacks the run really well, but he did face some challenging tasks, you know, at safety last year, whether it's, you know, having to cover Tyler Boyd one-on-one, had to cover George Kittle one-on-one and got gronked or kittled
yes,
now.
Twice.
Yes. So those are challenging roles. That's where part of that coverage grade is coming in, you know, where he struggled, but he's played in it was his first year playing more exclusively at safety. He previously had played in the slot, you know, could play all over the place. I think they're probably paying for some of that versatility. There is value in that, but yeah, you know, he's a better run defender than a coverage player. You know, just the fact that you don't necessarily trust him covering a Tyler Boyd in space or George Kittle one-on-one as he had to do last year limits him just a little bit, but you know, still a good player, even if it was a little overpay. I think safety wise, Jalen Thompson, last year's rookie fifth rounder, outplayed Deontay Thompson, the safety out of Alabama, who we kind of liked coming out, but had some athleticism limitations. Either the secondary is full of question marks, but I think if Peterson can at least get back on track, you know, he had one of his worst seasons. And again, he was struggling against some pretty good receivers. Robert Alford was supposed to be the guy opposite him. But he's hurt again, and that's why Drake Kirkpatrick's coming in. So there's a lot of questions there. I think it's going to be Peterson bouncing back, and then Byron Murphy, who did play well in the slot in college and played better there when lined up there last year. So it's going to come down to those guys. And then Isaiah Simmons adding that flexibility in the back seven. Losing Hassan Reddick as a starter could be a huge win for them, because he was really, really struggling from a coverage standpoint last year. And had, you know, great in the 30s, never really developed as a former first rounder.
Yeah, I thought for a second when I saw a picture of him recently that they'd given Isaiah Simmons Hassan Reddick's number, which would have been an interesting decision. But they haven't. It's 43 instead of 48, I think. Just enough to make you think it from a quick glance.
And they added 10 sack guy Jordan Phillips, Sam.
Yes, they did.
He had 10 sacks.
Mm-hmm.
Chandler Jones, sack guy, really good. Top 100 player last year, Sam.
Yeah.
Top 100 player with all those sacks. He was coming off his best pass rushing season last year, though.
We also ranked him high in the edge rusher rankings this season, but not high enough, obviously, for the Chandler Jones fans. He's a really interesting guy, because all the data that we've done has basically said that this idea of, like, finishing as an edge rusher, converting pressure into sacks, is not a repeatable skill. It's not something that you can actually get good at and be the difference between you being awful and you being really good. I think the reverse is definitely can be a failing, right? The Brandon Grahams of the world, like, for whatever it is, Brandon Graham will always, always be below par on where you expect him to be in terms of sacks relative to the number of pressures he has. And there's a few players that have been like that, but there's very, very few that are on the other end of the spectrum. On the other hand, Chandler Jones is one of those few. For his entire career, he has skewed sack happy, if you like, in terms of percentage of his pressure that gets converted into sacks. I think there are some explanations for that are not basically he's better than you think he is. But there's a percentage of it that kind of is, that like he is good at that.
I gave my theory when we discussed this the last time on the pod.
What was your theory? Remind me.
Well, using him and Brandon Graham, I think Graham is more of a burst top of the pocket winner. So Graham has a lot of like half man wins where he'll beat, say, like he'll get around the edge, but not completely clear the tackle and at least move the quarterback off the spot, but not be in position to actually complete the sack. He'll have a lot of those from a pressure standpoint, whereas Chandler Jones isn't explosive. He's not just flying to the top of the pocket. He's more of a hands winner. He's going to like square you up, do a karate move on you and get by you. So when he wins, he clears the tackle and then has more actual sack opportunities. So that's my very broad theory on just comparing those two guys, just the way they win and how they, you know, perform off the edge.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely a part of it. I'm intrigued because when I was writing the rankings, one of the things that stood out was how absurdly top-heavy, or not top-heavy, how absurdly deep edge rusher is in the NFL. Like, you're going 10 guys deep on these lists, and normally you're sort of hunting around for good players to make a top 10. Whereas here, you're like into the teens, and you're putting in players that are all pros, right? Knowing that you're going to take crap for it, right? It's like somebody is going to be mad that I'm ranking Za'Darius Smith 12th, even though, you know, last season was a massive outlier.
Even though he's got one good year.
Massive outlier from anything we'd seen in the past, and who knows, right? But the point is, there's like the 11 guys ahead of him are amazing. It's not like he's 12th because the guys in front of him suck. Like, you know, Myles Garrett is 6th, and you can make an argument that Myles Garrett is the best edge rusher in the NFL. Like, that's just how stacked that group is. So for a guy like Chandler Jones to be 13th, it's not a bad place to be. Like, you're still a really, really good edge rusher. But what's really interesting is that sack differential, because those are the most valuable plays. So from a sort of value standpoint, he might be doing more than we give him credit for, even though he's, you know, like he's 7th in terms of total pressures versus leading the NFL in sacks over the last 3 seasons, I think.
All right, so what are your thoughts on the Arizona defense taking a step forward? Is this going to be what holds them back, or can they take a step forward and match with that offense and actually compete for what, second or third in the division?
Yeah, I don't really understand what they're building yet. You know, they've got some really talented playmakers. They've got some pieces in place. They've added to it. I like the guys that they've brought in, with the possible exception of Jordan Phillips. I don't understand what this is supposed to look like yet. I need to see it on the field to get an idea of what it is they're trying to achieve, because a little like some of the other defenses we've talked about, the pieces just feel a little bit mismatched overall. You know, there isn't an obvious coherent synergy to the type of player they brought in or the positions that they're addressing. I don't quite get what it is they're building here.
Yeah, I think they'll improve in the back seven with Isaiah Simmons. I think Jordan Hicks has a history of playing really well in space, and he wasn't as good last year. I think they could take a big step forward at linebacker. Patrick Peterson bouncing back, and Byron Murphy playing like we thought he would. I think there's a lot of potential in that back seven. It's going to take those guys, though, playing well in that offense, then coming back, you know, taking that year two step forward, especially Kyler. So, I think Arizona's going to be tough. They might only win 8 games, but I think they're just going to be a tough team to play.
Yeah, I mean, this is a team that I think is moving in the right direction.
Play week in, week out. And they feel like, yeah.
I don't know if it's going to come together this year, but I think they will be really tough to beat.
All right, let's move on to the Los Angeles Rams. I've used this phrase before, the whack-a-mole roster building teams. I feel like the Rams are in whack-a-mole mode right now, because the offensive line, but they didn't actually attack They didn't actually whack the mole of the offensive line. They just kind of trusted what's coming back. But I think losing Brandon Cooks as a deep threat, even though he was only there for half the season last year, you lose him, you lose Dante Fowler, and you lose Corey Littleton. I just feel like they've got some holes to plug, and they don't necessarily have the personnel, and they're banking on that offensive line. Probably the biggest story here, that offensive line, which went from top 10 to number 31 in PFF rankings last year. Like, this season isn't going anywhere if the Rams don't get better up front.
Yeah. I mean, I said it last year in September that, like, this was a team coming off a Super Bowl. And in September, I tweeted that this team isn't winning anything unless this offensive line jumps massively in the right direction. And it didn't. If anything, it got worse. You're right. It's a really interesting approach. They've kind of done what the 49ers did last year with their secondary, which is say, we like the guys we have in the building. We think there's a giant jump forward to be had with this group, so we're not doing anything crazy. And, I mean, maybe you can – I mean, Whitworth will be solid. The decline of Rob Havenstein is one of the most absurd things that happened last year. I can see a good argument to saying, I have no idea why that happened. Maybe it was injury, so let's assume he's going to be good again. That gives you some solid bookends at tackle. And then you just need to somehow cobble together an average interior from the group that's there. Austin Corbett, Brian Allen, Austin Blythe, David Edwards, Sean Coleman, Joseph Noteboom. Like, there's so many guys. You would think that between all of them, you can get three viable, not even good, viable offensive linemen that aren't problems. Yeah, maybe. But I really think that's the key to this offense. We know the system is reasonably effective. I think you're right that, you know, a change in receiver is going to be an issue, but it's all going to come down to what that offensive line gives them. If it's passable play, they're going to be okay. If it's the same disaster it was a year ago, they've got problems.
Yeah, because Jared Goff is the classic tier three quarterback. That's where he landed in the rankings. I've been using this for a while, and we saw Goff, you know, he graded or performed and, you know, statistically was a top 10 quarterback in 2018. When the line was great, he had two underrated receivers in Robert Woods and Cooper Kupp, guys who've gotten open at like a top 10 rate in the NFL, percentage of targets that are open the last couple of years, plus had Brandon Cooks. When all of that stuff was going well, the run game, play action, all that, Goff performed pretty well. Last year was a struggle behind that offensive line, a lot more turnover-worthy plays, and just a tick slow. Just some weird decision-making from Goff. So, it's something to keep an eye on. For Goff and for the offensive line, can they actually bounce back offensively? Can, you know, we've been pushing this storyline all offseason. Can Sean McVay adjust his offense? Can he adjust to what the league has done to them, you know, taking the run game away a little bit and essentially taking away those passing concepts, which are really good against certain coverages, but they need to be able to evolve just a little bit. I do like what they have in the two tight ends and Tyler Higbee and Gerald Everett. I think it's going to be more tight end driven with those two guys and Kupp and Woods, with, you know, trying to replace Brandon Cooks with Josh Reynolds, with second rounder Van Jefferson. But I think we're going to see a lot more two tight end type stuff. But the Rams believe they need to run the ball, and I think that's what they're going to try to get back to early in the season.
And I think that pivot late in the season to more two tight end looks was evidence of that offensive system evolving and adjusting, right? We're not going to fundamentally throw everything out the window, but if we just tweak this and swap a third wide receiver for a tight end, we can run some of the same concepts, but against different personnel packages and at slightly different alignments, and we're seeing better effect. So I think there's at least evidence. Going into last season, there was a question mark that, look, we saw defenses start to change how they were defending this offense, and we saw zero evidence that the offense was going to change to counter that. Last season, it took a while, but we at least saw some evidence that, okay, the offense is now has now shown the ability to counter what it is that's changing in the defenses that are facing them. So I think that's a big thing that we've at least seen evidence now that this is not a system that is rigid and doesn't change and doesn't evolve. We've at least seen that they're capable of moving as well.
One of the concerns I had, though, is one of the adjustments that they did make down the stretch in that, you know, second 49ers game was, remember, every pass was like bootleg or a screen. And it felt like they were really being dictated to by the defense, right? It was like, this 49ers defensive line is so good, we can't just drop back. We can't just, you know, let Jared Goff sit back there and get crushed. We're going to move him out of the pocket. We're going to run screens to slow down the pass rush. On one hand, it's good game planning. On the other hand, it just felt like such a simple game plan that was being dictated by the defense. I think when, you know, McVay was so good when he came in and, you know, had answers for things and, you know, took the league by storm in 27 and 2018. So I think this is important. This whole concept of NFL geniuses and offensive geniuses and all that stuff. The NFL is about adjustments. The NFL is about sustained success, not being a flash in the pan. And I think it is, it's a massive year to see, can they, you know, are they just going to be another mediocre team again, or can they get back to that, you know, Super Bowl level? My concern from a roster standpoint, though, is they've just kind of slowly gotten worse over these last couple of years. So it might be the most challenging, you know, coaching job for Sean McVay and Zach Robinson and the rest of the coaching staff over there.
The it's interesting because I think you're right that this is one of those offenses that wants to run the ball and believes it's fundamental to everything they're doing. Not so much necessarily that establishing the run is what makes everything tick, but this idea of like everything is built off the run looks, right?
Yeah.
So that you kind of need the run looks in order for that to be a thing in the first place.
Just tie it to the pass game and play
right.
action and everything.
But what's interesting is this, like, they obviously believe that Todd Gurley is not Todd Gurley of old, and that guy's never coming back because of the injury, so they ship him out. They then go and spend a second-round pick. You know, they didn't have a first-round pick because of trades for Jalen Ramsey. They spent a second-round pick on a running back. And it's like, look, if ever there was a team that should be clear evidence that running backs go as the blocking in front of them goes, it's what's happened to this franchise over the past few years. You had an MVP candidate running back who looked like garbage when your offensive line was bad. Then when you got the number one run-blocking offensive line in the NFL, he looked like the MVP candidate. And then all that disappeared when your offensive line fell to pieces again. So I just don't understand how this team of all teams can come to the conclusion that running back is the problem. Like, we've seen that when the offensive line was good, Malcolm Brown stepped in and looked like Todd Gurley. Like, there was no drop-off. C.J. Anderson came off the couch and looked like Todd Gurley. There was no drop-off. So, nope. I mean, I don't understand that pick. I just – that seems like a mistake to me.
Yeah, that was the Bears last year, man. I mean, it was one of those, like, the Bears didn't have a pick until round three in 2019. This year, the Rams, they had the 2 second-round picks, and you used the first one on a running back, which, you know, we don't like in general, so – I don't love it either. Cam Akers is a nice player. He had no offensive line at Florida State, could barely get anywhere. He's pretty good in the pass game. So, you know, he's a pretty good player, but again, this is going to come down to teams at least somewhat buying into the run, Goff getting back on track, taking care of the ball better, which will be, the same thing I said about one of the teams in the last, episode. If you just 4 or 5% more clean pockets for Jared Goff. He was one of the highest pressure rates in the NFL last year. Not necessarily because he sold on to the ball, because it was the number 31 offensive line. 4 or 5% more clean pockets for Jared Goff, and this offense pretty much gets back on track. From a math and simplicity standpoint, like, that's it. To see if we want to see the Rams of old, I think.
What do you think about the defense?
So defensively, I ranked them as the worst linebacking group in the NFL. Aaron Donald obviously is there and dominant, and people were asking about what we kept saying. Dante Fowler had 15 sacks. Just to clarify, he had 15 sacks by PFF numbers, because we give full sack credit when you get close. He had 11 and a half by the NFL. Don't care, but he got to the quarterback 15 times and was a part of the tackle 15 times.
I hate that the NFL does that so much.
Right, and just to reiterate, they only do it.
Yes.
So that it adds up.
They do not do it because there is a qualitative difference between a full sack and a half sack. They are not making a determination that this guy only did half the work because somebody got there as well.
Yeah.
They are just making the numbers in the box score add up, which is a pointless exercise, particularly now. So, look, there are plays where a guy probably wouldn't have got a full sack if the other guy hadn't gotten there and split it with him, right? there are also plays where two guys just whoop their offensive linemen and are bearing down on the quarterback and murdering him at the same time. And I think most of them are plays that would not be different from the full sack if the other guy hadn't been there, as opposed to the other way around. So yes, he sacked the quarterback 15 times.
And then the fascinating story for this defensive line was Michael Brockers left. He went and signed a contract.
They came back.
In theory, with the Baltimore Ravens. To replace him, they picked up A'shaun Robinson, a similar player stylistically, a power player, a run-first type of player. And then Michael Brockers has the contract doesn't go through with the Ravens, and they just bring him back.
Mm.
So now they have two Michael Brockers. They have Brockers and A'shaun Robinson. They're going to be stout up front with those guys, I think, in the run game and everything. They need the protection for the linebackers, which we'll talk about in a second. But the biggest thing is always a compliment to Aaron Donald, because he's going to disrupt. You need somebody to clean it up and finish. So I think it comes down to, is it Leonard Floyd off the edge who they brought in? Another guy who's been better against the run than he has been as a pass rusher. And as I'm talking through this, let's not forget, you're in the division with the Niners. You're in the division with the Seahawks, who want to run the ball. Like, those guys will help in those games, because as long as teams are running, you'd rather stop the run. You don't want to get gashed for seven yards a pop. So that's fine. But I still think they need more explosiveness off the edge, and there's a lot of questions there.
This is possibly an unfounded theory that I should probably check out before voicing, but screw it. We're in it now. We might as well just let loose and see what happens. I think the disparity between Fowler's true sack total and his half sack NFL official total might actually speak to how reliant this unit is on Aaron Donald for other people's sacks, right? Like, the fact that he was splitting so many of those sacks basically, I suspect, shows you that, look, Donald is the guy blowing up these plays, and then, like, multiple other guys converge around it and clean it up and get the sack. I know for a fact that Fowler doesn't have, like, a ton of these plays individually. Like, he has a sack that was specifically generated by Aaron Donald causing the initial pressure. But I suspect that's what happens, that Donald blows it up, and then it's like the rest of the unit has to try and figure out how to bottle it up and get the sack. That's the question, right? Fowler, I think, was a big part of that and was a useful player in doing it. Do they have the Fowler again? Like, can Leonard Floyd become the cleanup player complement? Can the group as a whole platoon to take advantage of what Donald does, which is absolutely wreak havoc on offensive lines?
They got that guy, Samson, whose last name starts with an E, Sam. You want a Samson E? That's mean. That's mean. Samson Ebukam.
That's what he said.
Obo Okoronkwo.
There you go.
I mentioned Leonard Floyd. I mean, they might be able to stitch it together with those guys. Fascinating thing about Floyd, as I'm looking at this linebacker core, Micah Kizer was an intriguing player coming out of Virginia, but, like, his best thing was blitzing just blew up some running backs as a blitzer. That's, you got to do more than that. Traven Howard hasn't played a ton of football. Terrell Lewis comes in, was more of an edge. Another guy who's probably better against the run. But I was watching Leonard Floyd tape just out of curiosity again. I went back to college because he played more off the ball linebacker his last year at Georgia, despite being, 6'5", 2'4", just like he has a lanky edge defender type of frame. And he'll play some early down, Sam linebacker and all that stuff. But I just have massive question marks about that entire linebacking core, especially when you lose Corey Littleton, one of the best coverage linebackers in the NFL. He could match up with running backs, good zone player, forced fumbles, got his hands on passes. So I think the back seven takes a hit just because of the linebackers. So it's another year of question marks from a pass rush standpoint. You get a little bit worse at the linebacker. All that said, I think the secondary will be all right. You've got the full year of Jalen Ramsey, who's just, so good on the outside. Troy Hill, your boy, a good number two now. And one of my favorite draft picks of the entire draft, Terrell Burgess, the third-round pick out of Utah, who could play a little safety, could play a little slot. John Johnson's played good football at safety. Taylor Rapp's a solid player. So I think they'll be at least good from a secondary standpoint. I just have questions in the front seven outside of Donald.
Have you watched any of the Hard Knocks yet?
I have not.
I don't know that I've ever seen a smaller NFL player than Dante Dion. Like, I know we are, obviously he's a small guy, you could see it from the field, but it's only when you see the sort of Hard Knock stuff and you see them, getting taped up and in the locker room and stuff, you're like, oh my God, that guy is tiny. Like, I outweigh Dante Dion by 30-odd pounds.
He's listed at 5'9". He's really like 5'7", isn't he?
Well, whatever it is, but it's the weight that's the issue.
It's more
right?
the weight. He's
like, he is 150 pounds. You know the way Troy Hill is an undersized cornerback? Troy Hill outweighs Dante Dion by 33 pounds. Like, Jalen Ramsey, who is a cornerback, is 58 pounds bigger than Dante Dion. Like, he's a different human. I
love when you dive into the analytics like that.
I honestly do not know how a guy like that can function at the NFL level. How does that guy tackle a 225-pound monster wide receiver or a tight end, God forbid? I played with and against some guys, right, that were so slight and small, and they're probably in the same kind of category as that, 150-ish, where you're like, you suddenly realize that, oh, you can run right into these guys and it doesn't do anything. Like, they just do not have enough inertia. There's not enough mass behind them for it to be an issue. And I'm like 180. Like, how does that guy try and tackle George Kittle in the open field?
I don't know, Sam.
It boggles my mind.
I mean, we thought the same thing with watching him come out of Boise State, and he kept playing well and playing well. Fascinating player because he is so slight. But, man, you hate short, slight guys.
I don't hate them. I'm just – my mind is – like, most small guys in the NFL are short.
It's not nice.
But they're, like, stacked, right? Like, they have John Kelly as well, right? John Kelly's tiny, but he's built like a bowling ball. Like, he probably outweighs me by 20 pounds, and he's half my height. But Dante Dion has that mix of being both short and doesn't weigh anything. Like, I just – it's the first time in watching these Hard Knocks things where I've looked at a guy, and you suddenly like, what? There's nothing to him. He's a tiny person. Anyway, carry on.
So all that said – I think the Rams got worse as a team. I think they're trending in the wrong direction. However, it feels like last year was an uncomfortable season for them, right? They're coming off the Super Bowl. They didn't look right. They still finished 9-7.
Right.
And all that said, they have enough pieces in place. I think they're competing for a playoff spot. I just always worry about the entire NFC. This division's tough. The whole conference is tough. You need things to just go your way. But I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that they're competing for a wild card spot this year.
So particularly as just three of them. So I agree with you that I think like 1-53 as a roster, they're probably not as good as they were a year ago. On the other hand, I think they could actually net win purely based off if that offense continues to evolve and if the offensive line takes the kind of jump that they think it's capable of, right? Like that offensive line was a monstrous percentage of the reason they were capped in terms of how good they could be last year. And then the offensive scheme not evolving until late was a big part of it as well. So if those two things sort of right themselves, if they show that evolution continues on the offensive scheme, and if the offensive line gets back to being average as opposed to garbage, I think that papers over all of the other cracks. Like every other area that they potentially took a step back in, I think doesn't matter compared with those two things.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think, I would say that they're potentially strong in the right areas, but it's going to take, evolving and getting back to back to where they were in 2018. We're going to move on to the San Francisco 49ers. But first, want to tell you about our new favorite friends to play fantasy football with. It's Underdog Fantasy. Real money, man. We can wear. I see the $1 million label here, the marker that they've reminded us that they have. A tournament,
that'll
an entire $1 million tournament with Underdog. All you need to do is the fun part, which is draft. So it's a best ball situation. You forget about the injuries, the trades, waivers. You forget about setting your lineups, set it and forget it. And then you get into that $1 million tournament, just draft the best team and you have a shot at that $1 million. So sign up for Underdog today and enter the best ball mania for a chance at $1 million in prizes by going to underdogfantasy.com. Or you go to your app store and search Underdog Fantasy and just be sure to enter the promo code PFF after you make your first deposit. It's underdogfantasy.com or Underdog Fantasy in your app store. Enter the promo code PFF after you make your first deposit and have a shot to win $1 million. How many entries you make, Sam?
As yet, only a couple. But look, let's start rolling the dice here.
There's still time.
Let's go hard.
There's still time. underdogfantasy.com. NFC champion San Francisco 49ers. Are they next alphabetically in front of Seattle?
The alphabetical order of this division is chaos now. I don't understand what's going on anymore.
Let's go with the Niners. They, well, it was chaos when it was St. Louis and San Francisco and Seattle. At least moving to Los Angeles helped us out a little bit.
True.
So my same – here's the thing. When it comes to analysis, and the most recent thing you saw was the 49ers playing in the Super Bowl, much like we just saw the Rams play in the Super Bowl going into last season, it's easy to think that that team's going to be a top three team and that, you know, in the conference again and be right back in the mix. That hasn't been the case in recent history in the NFC. We've seen the Niners, the Rams, the Eagles, the Falcons, the Panthers, the Seahawks twice. I mean, that's the last time we saw a team actually get to the Super Bowl back-to-back years, the Seahawks in 2013 and 14. So it's just been a revolving door of top teams stepping up. So my concern for the Niners, we talk about teams playing whack-a-mole and all that stuff. If you say the Niners pretty much have the same roster, except they lost Emmanuel Sanders and then drafted Brandon Ayuk to replace him, who's now hurt. And they traded DeForest Buckner and drafted Javon Kinlaw to replace him. For me, it's not a comfortable feeling to think, well, the 49ers, they were good last year. They probably overachieved a little bit. They were so good. Wasn't expecting that. All that said is it's going to be really tough for them to duplicate what they did last season.
Yeah. I wonder how much the third wildcard spot will help that, will help mitigate the sort of the Super Bowl loser's curse. You know, the idea that the team that loses the Super Bowl never gets back anywhere near as good as they were the next year. Because typically they don't fall off the map completely, but they end up in that realm of, like, you're good, but you're battling for a playoff spot and you just miss out. Like, right. I wonder how many of those teams would make – that would be an interesting thing to go back and look at, is how many of those teams would have made it as a third wild card and still been able to, like, scare the crap out of some teams in the playoffs. Because, look, this team was in the post – you know, this team was in the Super Bowl a year from now. They've struggled through the year, but they're back in the postseason again, and you have to play them. That would be an intriguing thing. What I'm saying is the 49ers could take a significant step back this year and still be able to make the postseason because of that. I think they're in a good position to not fall off, though. I think with some of these teams, you could kind of see it coming in that the reason that they got where they got was sort of lightning in a bottle and probably not repeatable and inevitable that it would fall off, or the McVay thing, right? You were writing an offensive scheme that nobody had an answer to until late on you started to see it, and now you need to show version 2.0, and if that isn't there, you're going to drop off. I don't see any evidence that teams are anywhere near catching up to defending this offense. Like, this Kyle Shanahan system has been phenomenal from the outset. It's been dominant since the freaking 80s when it was in San Francisco. It's been dominant since Mike Shanahan was using it, let alone his son. And he has shown consistent evolutions. Like, Gary Kubiak has moved the system on. Kyle Shanahan has moved the system on. It has developed and evolved over the years consistently, which is why it's still so devastating. So I don't think you're going to go into 2020 and be like, well, we saw a good look at the 49ers last year, and now everybody figures out how to slow that down. Like, that offense is still going to be pretty devastating, and that alone is going to be a reason that this team is probably going to be looking at the postseason.
Yeah, that was the one thing I was going to say. If you just look at Kyle Shanahan and his history, just as offensive coordinator, he was with the Houston Texans in 08 and 09. He was one of the people that made Matt Schaub really good statistically. So he's, yes, I mean, and one of the best statistical quarterbacks of all time in that system. So he's had the Matt Schaub stuff. You know, he didn't have great quarterbacks in Washington, but they were reasonable. He had the peak year with RG3 as a rookie, turned Kirk Cousins into a pretty good player. Even with the Browns for 1 year in 2014, like, they looked reasonable on offense with, like, Brian Hoyer at quarterback. And then when he finally got Matt Ryan, there were some lumps in 2015, MVP candidate in 2016. And then here's the thing. He was with the 49ers going into last year. He essentially had six games of Jimmy Garoppolo where they looked like a legitimate team in 2017. Like, they won. They were tough to beat. They were awesome, because every other game with the 49ers was either a C.J. Beathard at quarterback, it was Brian Hoyer, or Nick Mullins.
He made Nick Mullins look like a pretty decent quarterback.
Yes. So, like, if you just look at Kyle Shanahan games in San Francisco with Jimmy Garoppolo, they're really, really good. And they are one of the better teams. So as much as I'm saying, hey, it's going to be tough to sustain and all that stuff, Shanahan has a baseline of success offensively. And you mentioned the evolution last year. They ran more gap scheme, you know, more power, counter plays than they had ever run in that system. It was usually like outside zone, and every variation of zone running. And then they've added more wrinkles to it. They added more, they use more motion than any team in the NFL. So they are doing, and Shanahan has done a great job of getting everything he can out of that offense, keeping defenses off balance, and all with, I think, another tier three quarterback in Jimmy Garoppolo. You know, when he has all that stuff going, he plays pretty well. When more is on his plate, there are more question marks, you know, throwing the ball down the field, throwing the ball without play action and all that fun stuff. Turnover worthy plays were just a random. He just had a weird year last year, man, where he would just chuck the ball right to a linebacker, completely misread a coverage once or twice a game when everything else was looking good. So, again, all that said, I think Shanahan has such a track record of success. As long as the quarterback isn't terrible, they should be right there. My question, I think, is duplicating what they did defensively, because that was the biggest leap forward of any team last year, and defense is the hardest thing to predict.
Yeah, I can't find the exact tweet that he had, but our friend Jeff Schwartz was talking about this Shanahan system the other day and tweeted something like he specializes in essentially causing defensive players, showing them something that isn't actually happening, right?
Yeah.
Deception, right? Giving them something that makes them ignore their keys, right? Because I know I should be looking at this, but oh, look, there's some fancy shiny thing over here. And that half beat where you just take your eyes off what you're supposed to be doing is A, like it's human nature. It's almost impossible not to look at that, to ignore it. But B, that half step is all you need. Like that's the difference between the play working or not. And he had a term for it and I can't find it because the man tweets a lot. I can't find the specific tweet that I'm looking for.
I mean, Jeff tweets about everything, man.
Yeah, but he had a good term for it and I can't find what it is. But he's basically saying that Shanahan specializes in that. Eye violations. I found it. Got it. Eye violations. He specializes in giving defenders eye violations, creating eye violations.
That's a good phrase. I like that.
Right?
It's better than playing the game through a straw.
Yeah, yeah.
If you are, all I'll say is if you're playing the game through a straw, Kyle Shanahan's going to be giving you all sorts of eye violations. How's that?
That was nice.
Oh, yeah. Lance. Anyway, I like the way our friend Joe Thomas laid it out, where he said so many offensive coordinators, they just pick plays from columns. You have the pass play column, you have the run play column.
Right.
And I picked a bunch of pass plays. Now it's time to run the ball, right? Like I haven't run the ball in a while. Whereas he described Kyle Shanahan's play calling as a story. Like this play is going to set up this other play, which sets up this next play, and it all flows together. And I think you definitely see that, and it matches what Jeff is saying. Like that motion that's, you know, taking the linebacker's attention, it's being shown for a reason, and they might come back to it and actually hand the ball off to that guy after, you know, you're ignoring it for two plays. So the play calling is great. And then from a skill player standpoint, the wide receivers are just all banged up. And that's where my concern is, depending on how much that carries over into the season. Deebo Samuel was fantastic as a rookie last year. He's so good after the catch. Brandon Ayuk was, again, supposed to be that guy who brings, you know, more yak ability because he averaged 10 yards after the catch per reception last year at Arizona State. So it's just more difficult playmakers to cover, but both guys are banged up. You know, Jalen Hurd is out for the season, the big bodied former running back who's a slot receiver. So they don't have great receiving talent right now. They just have George Kittle,
yeah,
the best all around tight end. And there's going to be a lot more pressure on him early on.
Well, they loaded up on these Deebo Samuel style players and then all of them got hurt. At the same time, it's bizarre. I mean, I think long term they'll be fine because these guys will come back. But right now, they're hurting for lack of receivers. But it's kind of like it's like what they were before Deebo and Emmanuel Sanders arrived, which is it's not that they don't have a number one receiver; it's that their number one receiver is George Kittle. You know, almost every team in the NFL, their number one receiver is a wide receiver. That's the toughest cover. That's the guy that's getting all the targets. That's where the ball is going. With the 49ers, it has always been George Kittle. And Emmanuel Sanders and Deebo Samuel came in to become incredibly good foils for that and great complementary pieces. But Kittle has maintained that spot as the number one the whole way. And they're back now because of all the injuries heading into the season, needing to lean on that more than they would ideally like to. I think as the season goes on, you'll see, you know, Deebo Samuel, what he can do. Obviously, the Brandon Ayuk element. You'll see the other guys emerge as different role players. And critically, I think somebody needs to fill that Emmanuel Sanders role, which is a legitimate threat in his own right, because he did transform this offense when he arrived. And, I mean, maybe a little bit surprising that they didn't try and retain him, given the impact that he had.
Yeah, he was good, man. Dig routes, post routes. I mean, he was getting open on your, call him your more traditional wide receiver routes. He wasn't a gimmick player. So I think you still need that guy in the offense. Running back-wise, it's always a committee approach with the Shanahans, who have always, not always, but they've always taken pretty much anybody and allowed them to be productive. But when Raheem Mostert was out there last year, man, they were fast. I mean, just using the NGS, you know, speed data, it was them and the Chiefs as the two fastest teams. And then when you add in both teams, they're eye violation creators, right? Both teams with all the misdirection and all that stuff happening. When you put the ball into a fast guy's hands in space, good things happen. That's Mostert. That's Tevin Coleman. They've got a lot of speed there in the backfield. They're the only team that actually has a threat at fullback in Kyle Juszczyk. So, man, I think they need the receivers to be out there. And until they're all healthy, though, they're going to be stitching it together with all these backfield components. Maybe they try to get something out of Jordan Reed as a rejuvenation project, as a tight end, too, with Kittle. But I think it's going to be, I think they have to regress at least a little bit offensively, right?
A little bit, but like I say, I think the fundamental components are too good for them to not be really good again. Obviously, yeah. Jimmy Garoppolo contingent. Like, if he's the quarterback, it's a different prospect than if Nick Mullins or C.J. Beathard is the quarterback. But, yeah, I mean, for in terms of speed, just look at the stable of running backs. Raheem Mostert, Tevin Coleman, Jarrett McKinnon, they're all of the same style, which is blazing straight-line speed, you know, the ability to slash into a gap and take off. Plus, you know, they've got a guy whose entire name is Hasty. Like, this is a backfield, backfield focused on speed.
Your analysis is always I can't wait to see what you bring out with Seattle.
Also, just quickly, the last thing on offense, huge move for them, losing Joe Staley to retirement, but replacing him with Trent Williams. Look, I think it's less of a sure thing. Trent Williams has missed some time. It's been a while since he was that good. But that is by far the best bet you could have to replace a Pro Bowl caliber tackle that you're going to have. Like, drafting one, grabbing another guy in free agency, like, that was the single best gamble you could make in terms of maintaining that level with zero drop-off.
So I guess this is my point. Like, from a fan standpoint, you look at the offseason and you're like, okay, did we get better from last year? What's going to make me feel better about 2020 rather than 2019? And for the Niners, I don't think there is anything. But they did a great job of maintenance, right?
It was, well, you went to the Super Bowl. You're probably not going to get better.
Well, I know that, but like, when you said, "Hey, Seattle might win the division," don't be surprised if Seattle wins the division. People are like, "You're crazy. It's got to be the 49ers."
Right.
Like, what makes you think that the 49ers are going to be even nearly as good as last year? Right. What is it? Because they lost Emmanuel Sanders, replaced him with a rookie. They lost DeForest Buckner, replaced him with a rookie. They lost Joe Staley, replaced him with Trent Williams. Those are all at best lateral moves at key spots, and then you need the defense to perform as well as they did last year. It's going to be a challenge. It's going to be difficult to even duplicate that. So what I'm saying is, it's tough to have to say, oh, we'll just be as good as we were last year, plus we added this, this, and this. It's like, okay, we barely remain status quo, and you know, last year we had some things go our way.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can make the case that some of the young guys will take a step forward, but I mean, just from the fundamental starting point of, you made it to the Super Bowl, we're a play away from winning, there is not that much room to go up from there. Like, there's a hell of a lot more room to go down from that point than there is up.
You're absolutely right. Maybe I'm just being mean. All right, defensively, Nick Bosa was a star last year up front. I think they were able to win up and down that defensive line. Nick Bosa, DeForest Buckner, he's out, as we mentioned. Javon Kinlaw comes in. Eric Armstead had a huge year. Still waiting for that Solomon Thomas breakout, Sam. Even when he's on the interior, he hasn't played well at all. He hasn't played well at any spot, the 2017 first rounder. But like every team, the back seven is where it's going to be won and lost. And they've got an athletic group of linebackers, Fred Warner, Dre Greenlaw, Quan Alexander, and all of his tackling issues. They're at least athletic there. They've got some range, good coverage players there. Richard Sherman looked back to form last year for the most part within this scheme. And you saw a career year from Jimmy Ward. I think their biggest question mark is going to be, you know, the second cornerback spot where Akella Witherspoon was burnt toast in the playoffs.
Yeah.
And they just did not get consistent play, even from Emmanuel Mosley, who, you know, kind of came out of nowhere and played well. But I think cornerback two is going to be the big question mark there. Is it Jason Verrett time?
Yes.
Is it Jason Verrett?
That's the thing. We are being teased. We're being suckered again. Jason Verrett. Lighting up training camp, looking like the superstar he is.
It looks like he did 12 years ago when he was good.
It's such, like, it's just, it's unfair. We're being teased with this idea that Jason Verrett could come back and look like an all-pro corner right out of the gate again, having been on the shelf injured for like 25 years. I'm not doing it. I'm not falling for it. I refuse to believe it until I see it on the NFL field. And even then, it's like Tyler Eifert, right? It's happening. I'm just waiting for the injury to come. So look, I think it was a gamble absolutely worth taking. Roll the dice. We know this guy has all pro talent. He's still young. Like, what are we losing by keeping him around and seeing if we can get a healthy season out of him? But at this point, like, the guy's played, what, 250 snaps or something in like 3 years? The chances of him actually being the player that he once was are so small. But if he is, like, I wrote a thing that was like the Achilles heel, essentially, of the four teams that everybody expects to be the class of the NFL: Baltimore, Kansas City, San Francisco, and New Orleans. And my Achilles heel for San Francisco was, who is that number two corner? If we assume Richard Sherman is still Richard Sherman, the number two corner essentially cost them last season. It almost cost them, like, it threatened to cost them a game against Minnesota when, like, Witherspoon was getting burnt. It then did cost them the Super Bowl when Witherspoon was benched, and it was Mosley that bit the wrong route on the play that the third and 15, the WASP, is that what they called it? To hit Tyreek Hill and change the game. So number two corner fundamentally cost them last season, and they haven't upgraded. So unless, you know, Jason Verrett comes back.
They had the top overall coverage grade in the NFL last year.
Yes.
Despite having Emmanuel Mosley played 747 snaps, 68 coverage grade, which is fine. It's solid, but again,
it's solid.
You know, you can still improve upon that. And Akella Witherspoon, he was a disappointment with a 58 coverage grade, including the playoffs. We thought he had some skills coming out of Colorado a few years ago. Kawan Williams has been really good in the slot. The concern with all this is all of our data says defense is overrated, Sam. Mm. That's it. It matters. Maybe, but it's overrated, and it's overrated in that it is just dependent on who you play. It's dependent on the offense. It's dependent on the quarterback and the receivers that you play. So one of the things you just wouldn't do going into the year is say, well, the Niners had a great defense last year, therefore it'll happen again this year, especially in the back seven. So that's the place where they'll most likely regress. Even with a talented group, you know, Sherman's also getting a little old. Don't tell him I said that. You know, he's starting to get old here,
yeah,
Sam.
That's a real concern.
The depth there isn't great.
Yeah, like Richard Sherman was back to his best last season, but like, he's old. Is that going to continue? Like, at some point, him getting back healthy is going to be offset by the fact that he's kind of old and going to be slowing down. It wasn't that quick to begin with. Like, and we saw it in the Super Bowl. I mean, he had a bad Super Bowl. He got beaten a few times by Sammy Watkins. There's plays throughout his season where he gets beat every now and again. Now, he's maybe the smartest cornerback in the NFL, not just because he went to Stanford, but in terms of, like, on the field, you can see he understands exactly what's happening at all times. He understands reads. He often beats receivers to where they're supposed to be. So he's going to age gracefully, I think, because so much of what makes him great is in his head, and that's not going to disappear. But at some point, the fact that you can't run with these guys is going to be a problem.
So then again, going back to this like coverage versus pass rush debate in that I mentioned in the Rams section that they had that game week 16 against the 49ers, the Rams did, where they were like afraid to throw the ball down the field without at least some sort of boot action or whatever. They were afraid of the defensive line, which speaks to just how good the Niners were up front. But with that strategy, the Rams still threw for over 300 yards, scored 31 points. The point is, I think you can scheme against a defensive line. And even if they force you into maybe a suboptimal offensive game plan, you could still be productive throwing the ball. So the Niners, their strength, I think, is the defensive line, right? Going into this year, knowing you have Nick Bosa and Eric Armstead and Dee Ford and all these guys who can get after the quarterback, but they need a performance at least close to what happened in the back seven, because they'll run into some teams that, as good as the defensive line is, they'll be able to mitigate it schematically.
Yeah, and I think there's also question marks about how repeatable is what that defensive line was doing. Like Eric Armstead, massive career year, contract year as well. So do we expect that to continue, or was that just like one monster year to get paid and then go back to being okay? Dee Ford was really good when he was on the field, did kind of back up the contract year that he had in Kansas City, but didn't play enough. So he's a bit of a question mark, not so much that his, I think, play will decline, but just how much is he going to see the field. Javon Kinlaw, as we said, is a rookie. Nick Bosa was insane out of the gate, and I think we just sort of assumed that will continue.
But it will. That's the one I believe in. He'll be fine.
Well, so here's the thing. Did you PFF Moo, Timo Riske, wrote an article about the progression. You know, we've said a lot of these things intuitively and just through anecdotal data or clumsier mathematical data ourselves. But, you know, this idea that development is not always linear. And if you have a rookie that hits the ground running and dominates out of the gate, it's actually more likely they'll get worse in year two than it is that they'll get better, right? Like if somebody is that good right out of the gate. Now, there's three positions that are exceptions to that. Wide receiver was run. I think edge rusher might have been the other, or one of the others. But just because Bosa was so absurdly good right out of the gate, I think it would be a mistake to expect him certainly to get better. I can see him maintaining that level, but let's not expect him to become, you know, let's not expect him to become the best edge rusher in the NFL in year two because he was top 10 in year one.
I'm merely thinking we've got a lot of Bosa data, Nick and Joey, yes, and they're just always good. True. So I think they'll be fine.
But Joey is a good example. Like Joey took a step back in year two, didn't take a step forward.
He did. So anyway, let's put a bow on the 49ers. I feel like I've been a little negative because I crazily said that the team that made it to the Super Bowl last year is not going to be as good this year.
You did.
I want to put a positive spin on it. What I was most impressed about by the 49ers last year was their ability to win every type of game. You know, they won a shootout against the Saints where they had to throw the ball a ton. They ran for 10 yards a pop against the Browns on Monday Night Football. They won games in the rain. They gave the Ravens a really good game on the road. You know, they were really competitive in all sorts of different style games. And let's not forget, they made Patrick Mahomes look pretty bad for the better part of three quarters.
Yeah.
Or the better part of a game, right? At least three quarters. And then in the fourth, you know, it kind of fell apart. But so there's a lot of good things about the Niners did last year, including that versatility to win numerous ways. So I think they're still one of the better teams. I think it's just such a deep NFC. We're going to see a regression from a record standpoint, but they'll be good. They'll be competitive as long as Shanahan is leading the guys. Leading the guys. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Running the show.
Yes. I mean, I think that's fundamentally the point, right? Is that the building blocks of this team are too good for them to disappear completely. I can see them regressing because, like I say, there's way more room to get worse from the Super Bowl than there is to get better. But I think this is still a team that should be contending for the division and should certainly be aiming to make the playoffs.
All right, let's wrap it up with the Seattle Seahawks. Russell Wilson, we just gave him the boost, Sam. We just elevated him to tier one at quarterback. Have I done my little rant about the MVP votes on the podcast?
Probably.
Why, like, I know, we repeat ourselves a lot, but that's like the common thing here. Why is everybody citing the fact that Russell Wilson hasn't received any MVP votes as some sort of like slap in the face and of disrespect? And look, the AP voters, there are questions in the group. There are question marks. It's not the finest 50 NFL people.
I do believe that there is room to improve that group. Let's put it that way.
Let's stay PC here. But the idea that people are like, Russell Wilson, he's been good since he entered the league. How's he not had an MVP vote? Because until last year, he never should have had one. That's why. Like, they were right by not giving him an MVP vote in any other year. He's been a very good quarterback, but the last two seasons, he has elevated himself to a tier one quarterback. From an MVP standpoint, in 2018, it's all Patrick Mahomes. He was the guy. He deserves all the votes. From last year, though, if you just isolate Russell Wilson versus everybody else, he was our most valuable quarterback. He's a tier one quarterback who I think has, you know, went from good to really, really good the last couple of years, elevating his team. He didn't have the same type of supporting cast as Lamar Jackson and some other quarterbacks. So I don't know, just the idea that like he's never had an MVP vote, slap in the face for Russell Wilson is kind of silly. But all that said, he's officially a PFF tier one quarterback up there with Patrick Mahomes.
So I agree with you fundamentally that there's never, well, there, no, actually, I don't even agree with that. I was going to say I agree fundamentally that he's never had a year where he should have won MVP, but I think he probably should have won it last year, or at least that he should have definitely had votes. Like, there wasn't
right, but all I'm saying is last year's like the only year. The way people say it is
okay,
like, can you believe
but anyway,
he's never had an MVP vote?
Even if we move past that and we say there's never been a year where he should have won MVP, I think the problem is that when you look at the list of people that have had votes in that time, then Wilson is shunned. Like, Derek Carr has six MVP votes in his NFL career. DeMarco
Bobby
Murray
Wagner
has two. Dak Prescott has one. Bobby Wagner has an MVP vote, and and Russell Wilson doesn't. Like, compared with that, he is getting hosed. Like, there's no way you can say that at any point Bobby Wagner was more valuable to the Seahawks than Russell Wilson. And Derek Carr, I mean, okay, it's the 2016 season where he was legitimately good, but like the idea that Derek Carr has six MVP votes and Russell Wilson has zero, when you look at it in those terms, he is getting hosed.
Fair. Anyway, I think he's, you know, Wilson's been great. You know, the big thing last year was avoiding some of those bad games, and you know, they've done a nice job of attacking down the field. So as much as our analytics community likes to talk about Seattle's holding him back and they run the ball too much, they have taken some off his plate and then played to his skill set by allowing him to throw the ball down the field more, where he is great, where he is the highest graded passer throwing 20 plus yards over the last few years. They've added a DK Metcalf who is just so difficult to defend on those downfield passes, and Tyler Lockett, and now they add Philip Dorsett to the mix as he'll probably get behind the defense a few times and just add, you know, more explosiveness to that offense. So I think there's things to be excited for offensively. All that said, I would still probably put the ball in his hands a little bit more and throw the ball more than Pete Carroll and Schottenheimer want to do.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think there is a very real conversation to be had about this idea of let Russ cook versus the Seahawks interpretation, which is, well, he's been the best quarterback he's ever been when we've taken the ball out of his hands more than we did in the past. I don't know that I've seen a convincing, compelling case either way that there is like definitive proof that one causes the other. I wrote today the same kind of thing about Aaron Rodgers. I think that's what the Packers are trying to do, is the Seahawks Russell Wilson approach, which is he'll become the best Aaron Rodgers we've seen for years if we dial back what we're asking him to do. Now, the question is that causation or is that just coincidence? Like, is Russell Wilson, did he have back-to-back career years because the Seahawks have dialed down the amount of time the ball is in his hands? Or did he just have back-to-back career years coincidentally at the same time they did that? And I honestly I haven't seen anything that is compelling proof either way. And that's the problem, right? Is as much as all the data says, well, he's so phenomenal in this circumstance and passing is more valuable, so give him the damn ball more. The Seahawks fairly will respond with, well, look, he has never been better than how he has been since we went to this approach. So we're not going to load more onto his plate and hope that it continues, because if it doesn't, we destabilized everything.
Yeah, I mean, I think fundamentally they look at a macro level of how successful has the team been, and they just try to correlate it directly to how much has been on Wilson's plate. I mean, I really just think that's how they look at things. So 2013 and 14, they won the Super Bowl and then could have won the Super Bowl. And in theory, in their head, it was a Marshawn Lynch driven team. It was Marshawn Lynch. It was the run game and defense, right? In their head, Seattle and Pete Carroll, that's how they won. I think in 2014, they started to put a little bit more on Russ, and they lose in the NFC. In 15, they put more on his plate. And, you know, statistically, he was really good. But they weren't as good. And they lose in the divisional round. And then in 16, you know, they lose in the divisional round. And in 17, they didn't even make the playoffs. And that was the biggest thing, right? In 2017, they didn't make the playoffs, and they couldn't run the ball. And again, Wilson had 34 touchdowns, and, you know, stats are great and all that stuff, but they didn't make the playoffs. And then the next year, they go run heavy attack. Wilson played better, but threw the ball, 100 fewer times, including the postseason, 100 right. fewer times. So in their head, and all they were was one game better in 2018. That's all they were, was one game better, and they made it to the playoffs.
But you know,
and that's how they're thinking about this.
The other thing is that it's one of those things that's way easier to say than to actually break down the practicalities of doing it. Like, we talk about it as, you know, just move the slider up a bit, right? Like, Russell Wilson's right. down here.
Just
move it up a little bit. Just edge it up and get him to pass more and see what happens, right? But when you break down what that actually means over a season, like, each game is – or each season is 16 different games, which have their own game flow at stake and different pressures working on them. So there's only so many plays that are sort of like free choices, right, between run and pass, as opposed to obvious pass situations, obvious rundowns. So what you're really talking about is like fundamentally shifting something in a guy's head so that in a given neutral down, you're going to call more pass plays than run plays on what is a really small subset of like game or plays that are not massively influenced by game flow and a bunch of other things at the time, right? Well, which is really hard to do. Like, you've got a guy, particularly for a coach like Pete Carroll, that's been doing this since like the 1970s, like to suddenly right. expect that guy to, in his brain, just have the percentages shift a little bit so that the next time they're facing first and 10, he's like, you know what? Call a pass play. Let's let Russ cook more. Like, it's not as simple as just like shift the slider up a little bit.
So the mentality switch is it's in those situations, as you said. It's like on first and 10 or second and 8, right? It's instead of let's get another run in there to get it to right. third and 5 or to get it to second and 7 or whatever it is. It's now we got to call quick game. It's not as simple as call more play action, because sometimes you could probably run more play action on first and 10, but a lot of times, you know, if it's Brady or Breeze, it's like, all right, we're just going to go empty on first and 10, and we're going to run quick game because we know he's going to find an open guy and we're going to pick up 6. Right. And so that's but when you do that with a Brady or a Breeze, it's like, well, that's their game, quick game, short area stuff. They're awesome at that decision-making, whatever. With Wilson, he's pretty good at it, but you don't feel like that's his game. You know, the best stuff Wilson does is down the field, 20 plus yards off of play action or right. outside of structure. That's part of it too, is the fact that yeah. so much of his game is outside of structure. And as a play caller, you want structure. If I call an empty pass on second and 7, I want you to hit the open guy and pick up the 6 yards that the scheme is giving you. Wilson's not always going to do that.
But
at the same time, how did I just describe that? 6 yards,
right?
5 and 6 yards on first down or on second and 7 is a great play, even though sometimes they feel easy. Whereas if you did that from a run game standpoint, you need a lot of good things to happen just to pick up 5 or 6.
But you're already
so I think that's part of it.
You're already really condensing down the sample size, right? From this idea of just up the slider a little bit over the 1,000 plays you play in a season. Like, now you're down to, you know, a few plays a game where it's the neutral situation and you're going to lean more towards the pass. And I know it's Schottenheimer, not Pete Carroll, that's going to be calling these plays, but it's the same thing, right? You've got a guy
that starts from the top down, though.
Yeah, yeah, but you've got a guy that's been stuck in this way of doing things for years. It's really hard to just adjust the percentages in that guy's brain so that he suddenly wants to default more to a pass than a run in a certain subset of plays. Like, it seems like it should be easy, But fundamentally, it's a more complicated thing than that, that I don't think we necessarily consider when that debate gets had.
Yeah, and again, I think the thing that we've considered that maybe our colleagues haven't is just how coaches are just uncomfortable with the unknown. And there's two Russell Wilson unknowns. It was prior to last year, he had those dud games. He really had those games where it's quick game, and here's this open receiver, and he'll stare at him and then just not throw it. I mean, he has games where he just doesn't see the field. It's a handful of games, but he has that. And that's an unknown for a coach. I don't know if he's going to pick up five when it's there. I don't know if he's going to take too many sacks. We know he's probably going to take too many sacks. And first and 10 becomes second and 15 instead. So that's an unknown. Which Russell Wilson's going to show up, and then which Russell Wilson will Russell Wilson play within the scheme and actually execute what you're saying. All that said, that discomfort is worth it because bad Russell Wilson is still better than a good running game. That's part of the problem, right? Is like an uncomfortable couple quick game calls are probably better than your, running power into an 8-man box over and over again.
That's the selling point. But for the Seahawks, again, it's this idea of like, well, what we're doing right now, whether or not it is the optimal way of playing, is resulting in an MVP caliber quarterback, right? A guy that's a tier one in a group of two in the NFL. Now, what you're saying is if we do a couple of different things, we could get even more of that. We could get the MVP caliber quarterback who's got control of the game even more and we're amazing. Alternatively, it could make him worse. And we spoiled the thing that was so great. Like, there must be an incredible temptation for them to be like, look, we have this thing that's working pretty damn well right now. Why in God's name would we keep trying to tweak it and make additional changes at the risk of ruining the whole thing? So, again, I think there's a real sort of a fair fear and a fair thought approach from the Seahawks that is why they haven't just given in to the data that says let Russ cook.
I would say the thing that's in Russell Wilson's favor is if you look at just how productive he's been, he's generally had pretty good receivers. Doug Baldwin was underrated and really good, and they've had guys to throw to through the years. But at the same time, it's like on paper, you're not like Tyler Lockett's really good. He was underrated. He's excellent, but they maximize DK Metcalf, as I mentioned. They've gotten 17 plus yards per catch out of David Moore. That's why I think, Philip Dorsett could sneak 400 or 500 yards, this year as just a primary deep threat. He's maximized what he's had. They've got old Greg Olsen at tight end. Will Disley's just all of a sudden like this big play tight end when he really shouldn't be. So Wilson has elevated his supporting cast, and that's one of the criteria for that tier one quarterback.
Yep.
The other thing is the offensive line. It is a hybrid of a poor pass blocking offensive line, but also Russell Wilson making them look worse by inviting more pressure. But it's one thing he's always made work and that they've survived with. I guess my concern there is for all the running that they want to do, it's still not even a great run blocking offensive line. Even when they have Mike Iupati, all these guys who look like big mauling run blockers, they're just not as effective as you would want for a team that's going to run the ball so much.
Yeah. I mean, the offensive line is not going to be great. It's never great with Russell Wilson there. They've never had a particularly strong group in front of him, and I don't know that it matters a whole lot. I'm kind of intrigued by the receiving group, though, because Tyler Lockett is really good. What does DK Metcalf look like in year two? He was a very polarizing draft prospect when he came out and obviously hit the ground running more than he struggled. So can he add more to his game? Can he become that sort of true, complete number one receiver that does everything well and is just a terrorizing player to have to deal with because of his size, strength, speed, all those kinds of things? Or are the concerns that people had limiting enough that he becomes a sort of an effective but a relatively one-dimensional weapon?
Well, let's go to the defensive side of the ball here, unless you want to talk about Seattle's running backs. Rashad Penny, breakout season.
Yeah, that did.
Look at that backfield. They have Chris Carson, who's been the best of the bunch. I mean, that guy makes people miss.
And is really good, yeah.
Is really good. It's, he maximizes what the O-line isn't giving him.
Yes.
He still makes something happen. Carlos Hyde, who actually ran the ball all right last year out of nowhere. And then Rashad Penny, who, when healthy, has been okay. He's been pretty decent. But they're, I mean, they're looking to run the ball again with the, you know, three-headed backfield. Penny's banged up, but Hyde and Carson to start the season in the run-heavy attack.
Penny banged up, you say? That's not usual.
Yeah, it's very, very rare. The secondary now on the defensive side of the ball, this is where they go from, I mean, this has been the difference the last couple of years. The Legion of Boom disappearing, not replacing, not even coming all that close to replacing them, but this is the best secondary on paper that they've had. It's a little dependent on Quentin Dunbar looking like he did last year in a pretty small sample size with the Washington football team. Jamal Adams coming in as the best all-around safety in the NFL now. This looks pretty good. Shaq Griffin can play more of a complementary role. He doesn't have as much pressure on him, Shaquille Griffin. The secondary is looking pretty good. The defensive line, we ranked 32. Yeah. So it's not exactly the whole Legion of Boom era where they had a good pass rush and a good secondary, but the back seven is one of the NFL's best.
Dunbar dodging whatever legal issues those were, it has the potential to be absolutely huge for this defense because he was a perfect fit for this scheme. And he was a bad fit for the one they want to install in Washington. And it's why they basically let him go for peanuts, possibly with the addition of knowing there were some off-field issues coming down the pike, or at least potentially on the horizon. You know, they've dealt with him more than we have, so who the hell knows? But apparently he's clear with those now. So him starting opposite Shaquille Griffin, Quandre Diggs in the mix as a nickel, as a safety in the box, and then Jamal Adams there. Like, this defense on the back end could be really special. They're talking about using a guy like Marquise Blair as like the dime linebacker to just patrol the box and be Cam Chancellor and bury people. You know, absolutely.
That's what he does.
Right.
That's what he does.
Tombstone them in tackles. Like, I am really excited about the back end, particularly when you add in, you know, the Bobby Wagner is still there. KJ Wright is still a quality player. We don't know what we're going to get out of Jordan Brooks yet, but the coverage and the back end has the potential to be really special. I just don't see that it's going to get any kind of compliment from the defensive line.
Yeah, I mean, Wagner took a slight step back last year, but he's still, you know, with Luke Kuechly gone, the highest graded linebacker in the NFL over the last few years. KJ Wright.
Dry schematically.
He was, yeah. And KJ Wright, same thing, like lowest grade in a while, but he had graded 65 plus for like the last 8 years previous to that. The Brooks thing is intriguing because we mentioned this at around draft time, like Seattle drafts people as much as they draft players. Like, they draft culture and, you know, guys that fit in, and it's like, oh, by the way, he plays linebacker. You know, I don't think that they went out there and were like, hey, we need a linebacker, because, you know, Wagner and Wright or KJ are going to see the field mostly. But this linebacking core is the NFL's best with Wagner, with Wright. Jordan Brooks did grade really well last year, mostly against the run, has some coverage ability, but it's a question because he didn't make a ton of plays in college. Even like Cody Barton's pretty good and Ben Burke-Kirvin, like, they've got so much depth all across the back seven. But what we were saying is, who is rushing the quarterback right now?
Well, also with the linebackers, the question is, are they going to do what they did last year, which is run base defense twice as much as anybody else in the NFL? Like,
right.
The league as a whole is like 75% nickel at this point, right? It's absurd. It's way like base is 25% of your standard defense now. It's one out of four downs. And it's more than that, obviously, because fourth down is typically the special teams play. But it's a tiny fraction. And yet the Seahawks were running it like 70% of the time a season ago, which is so far in a, like, out ahead as an outlier of anybody else. Like, nobody else is even in the discussion. Nobody else, I think, was within half of that in terms of percentages.
It was fascinating.
Right. And so I think a big part of that is they honestly believe that their third linebacker was better than their nickel corner options. Is that still the case? Like, because they might have been right, but it didn't make it good. I mean, what you asked of those three linebackers last season was really tough on them. And I think that's why we saw a massive down year in terms of PFF grade from Bobby Wagner, from KJ Wright. They didn't become worse players overnight. They were just given worse, harder roles to execute. So are we still going to be hanging those guys out to dry this year? Or have we got enough added to the secondary now where we feel confident that there's an answer to the slot in the defensive back room? Because that would be huge.
So just like the Ravens last year where we said, here's a good test case. for this coverage versus pass rush debate. That,
well,
you
this
know,
is extreme.
This is, yeah, this is extreme, but there's also a difference here. Like, in part of this concept of build from back to front, the second step that we always say is, well, it's because you can scheme up pressure.
Yeah,
I guess the problem with Seattle is they're a four-man rush team. You know, they'll bring five every now and again, but this defense is still Seattle cover three for the most part with a four-man rush. Like, if Baltimore last year just sent four all the time, they're in trouble. They schemed up pressure. They blitzed more than any team in the NFL, and then, oh, by the way, had one of the best secondaries. Seattle has this, on paper, really nice back seven, really nice coverage unit. But, man, if, you know, L.J. Collier had, what, one solitary pressure last year as a first-round rookie. He was banged up most of the time. Bruce Irvin off the edge, Benson Maioa and Rasheem Green, and, you know, they drafted two defensive ends, and Darrell Taylor and Alton Robinson, both, like, you know, they're solid players. Taylor, solid. He was a second-rounder, probably should have been a third-rounder. But, man, I don't know where these guys are winning. And the interior is the same thing. Jaron Reed had 10 sacks a couple years ago, but the grade didn't match it. So, you know, that's tough to duplicate. Same thing.
Yeah, I mean, this could be a really interesting experiment of how good can a defense be if the secondary is – or how good can a secondary be if the defensive line can't get any pressure whatsoever. Like, I don't know that Baltimore's defense last year would have been in trouble if they had just rushed four and hadn't schemed up pressure the way they did. But you're right that they wouldn't have been anywhere near as good as they were. It's the synergy between the two that made them a really imposing defense. Like, the Seahawks, in theory, schematically, are not going to be doing that. So this defensive line, unless somebody in it is going to have a dramatically better season than there's any evidence to suspect they will, like an L.J. Collier becomes the first-round pick that they thought he was as opposed to the player that everybody else thought he was, unless one of those guys does something completely unexpected, it is going to be an exercise in how good can your secondary be if your defense does not help out with any kind of pressure up front.
It's another great story, right? How is this defense going to evolve? The Russell Wilson workload thing, you know, do they evolve at all offensively? There was that one game. Remember the one game last year against the Bucs? They came out and they looked like the Chiefs. You know those first Chiefs drives?
Yeah.
Where they throw the ball like 10 straight times and there's four screens and everybody seems to be open and it's just all flowing. Like, that was Seattle, that one game against Tampa Bay. And it's like, wow, that's great. Good scheming, good everything, you know, good flow for Russell Wilson. He was awesome that day. Like, if they could do more of that.
If you wanted to flip the switch or crank up the slider, that's how you would do it. It's on those scripted plays because, I mean, the Chiefs are one of the most pass-happy teams in the NFL anyway, but they push the envelope even more on those scripted plays. Like, the first 15, they're absurdly pass-happy generally, and they're absurdly effective in terms of being pass-happy as well. Like, when Andy Reid is scripting the plays for the first 15 as an arbitrary cutoff, the sliders go up to 11, right? They go way pass-happy, and they're way more effective than normal when they do it. So if you were trying to give the Seahawks like a way of just letting Russ cook without fundamentally changing everything that's going on in the coach's brains, that would be the way to do it. It's to sit down and say, all right, whatever our play sheet normally looks like for the scripted plays, 15, if it's seven runs, seven passes, let's change that dynamic, right? Now we're going to pass 12 times instead of seven. Like, that's how we're going to change this. I think would be a very real and fair thing to do is – Let's tinker with the script. Let's push the envelope early in games and then
pretend it's the fourth quarter, Russ. Go get them.
Then, like, default to how we normally call a game. But for these plays where we script them anyway, let's try more pass-happy stuff.
All right, let's wrap it up, Sam. Who's winning? Who's going to win the NFC West?
So when I did my predict the season thing, I called the Seahawks, right? But a big part of that was, look, there are surprises every year, and if you just pick the favorite for every division, it would be a waste of everybody's time reading the thing. So let's try and predict some surprises. And I can see an easy way the Seahawks win. They fundamentally are working with the best quarterback in the division by a distance. That is a huge advantage any given season. On the other hand, there's enough flaws in this roster that I don't know that they're going to do it. I think it will
just go bold. Make a bold pick.
Screw it. Seahawks. Seahawks will win the division.
You. Me, I'm afraid of the bloggers, so I'm taking the Niners. I don't want the blog post about Palazzolo picks the Seahawks over the Niners, the obvious pick. So I don't want that. I'm afraid. So I'll take the Niners.
So you'll happily throw me under the bus so that you can hide.
Oh, absolutely.
In the shadows.
They've already blogged about you. You've already gotten criticized and you've gotten fired Joe Morgan's. Did they go line by line about your stupidity or did they just write an article about it?
I think it was just an article about it. Now it's going to be like Monson doubles down on stupidity.
Doubles down. Perfect. So great. That's what I'm trying to
Excellent.
Do is set
Thanks.
You up.
Thanks.
NFC West. That's it. We've previewed all 32 teams and it only took us like 100 hours of content to make it happen. Go back and listen to all of our division previews if you haven't already. And, yeah, don't forget PFF.com. We've got the two great products out there. We've got all of our NFL stuff, PFF Edge and Elite. The fact that you can get a free PFF Edge, and that was news to me today. I didn't know we were handing out PFF Edges.
Nice.
All you have to do is deposit at Monkey Knife Fight. Put in at least $20 into your account using the promo code PFF, and boom, PFF Edge annual subscription is yours. So Monkey Knife Fight, PFF is the promo code, $20. Put it in there and get your PFF Edge for half the price, really.
Yeah.
Also, plus the ability to invest.
Sneaky place to go. If you go to the main page, scroll all the way down to the bottom in the footer, there's a special offers page that'll show you all the available promo codes and stuff that we have running.
On PFF.com?
Yeah. It's hidden at the bottom, but if you scroll all the way down, special offers in the footer, you'll find it, and that'll give you the discount codes that are running.
Perfect, because that was where I was going
to
say
subscribe.
Sorry, that was where I was going to say the other one is the fantasy subscription. We still have that promo code going.
Oh, I just closed the page. Damn it! I don't know.
I don't want to sell it if we can't. But
well, that's a good call.
We have the new college football product that's out there. All the grades, premium stats, the PFF college magazine, which was just fantastic. So all sorts of great stuff over at PFF.com. And we are done with all of our division previews. We'll be back on Monday with just some general NFL news, maybe answer some questions and just get back to a nice flow. So thanks to everybody for tuning in. I'll hopefully be back in studio COVID-free.
Officially disease-free. That would be nice.
Yeah, that would be nice. All right, guys. Thanks for tuning in. See you Monday.
All right.